With Terrell, Terrell, Sessoms, Sessums. Speaker of the House of Representatives, Tallahassee, Florida, May 20th, 1974.
Yeah, what we're up to with this book that we're doing.
Really, one of the things I was intrigued by here is the fact that someone like you, who's relatively young, and is the Speaker of the House and is retiring, as I understand.
Well, in Florida, we have developed the tradition of rotating the leadership in the House and the Senate both. And I have really, I guess, relatively little seniority compared to many legislatures, but I've served since 1963. And I will have, by the end of this term, checked off my list most of the major legislative concerns I had. And while I've enjoyed being Speaker for the 2 years, I've had about all of it I can afford, and would be quite willing to turn the gavel over to my successor. I first ran for the legislature back in March of 1963, when Florida began to start reapportioning the legislature. I had, in college, been a political science major and had been very much interested in government. Then went on to law school. Went to Tampa to practice law in 1958. And after I'd been there about a year, our state senator at the time, who is now Congressman Sam Gibbons, who represents our district in the Congress, invited me to serve as his aide during the 1959 legislative session, and then at the 1961 legislative session. I took a leave of absence from my law firm, came up here and worked with him just during the 60-day session. That was before we amended the Constitution in 68, so the legislature met every other year. And it was a very interesting experience for me. At that time, Governor, well, let's see, I think in 59, Governor Collins was still the governor. We were having a great deal of turmoil over the integration of the public schools and a great debate over reapportionment. And it caused me to believe that perhaps the most important thing that needed to be done in Florida was to reapportion its legislature, because most of the men I encountered up here who served in the House or Senate generally represented a point of view held, by I guess a majority of the citizens within about a 50 or 75 mile radius of Tallahassee, and were not overly representative of the people who lived in the more urban parts of the state in Central and South Florida. And it was just sort of like going to a different world when you came to Tallahassee. And Senator Gibbons had defeated a senator from our county who was quite well accepted by what we used to call the pork chop gang, and many people in our area felt did not do a very good job of representing our interests. And when Sam served in the Senate, there was a great antagonism on the part of the majority in both houses to any suggestion of reapportionment. And in fact, the problem was to preserve as many as a third of the Senate to uphold the governor's veto of last resort legislation to close the public school system and some things of that nature. And I became pretty committed to seeing what could be done to reapportion the legislature, and assisted in, the majority approach up here was to do something, but to do as little as possible. And there were some campaigns on, in fact, their approach was not to use a statutory approach to reapportion, but simply to pass out constitutional amendment that made some minor change and delay the thing until the people voted on it, and then they had very little to vote on anyway. So we went through one or perhaps two of these constitutional amendment elections. But finally, in 1963, they did add some new seats to some of the larger counties. And I ran for and was elected to one of the seats added to Hillsborough. And I think most of the new people who were elected then came up feeling that the most important thing that needed to be done was to continue to reapportion the legislature. And that was the main tug of war, really, from about 1963 till 1966, 1967. With the background in history and political science, it just I began to feel that we weren't going to ever get anything done unless it was done by revolution or divine intervention, because the people who control the legislature were just not willing to be persuaded that it was right to not allow them to exercise control. And finally, the United States Supreme Court added a lot of impetus to efforts to reapportion. That was a period when I came into legislative service, and I think we have now properly reapportioned the legislature. Many of the things that needed to be done have been done. We're a long way from the millennium, but
You said that in 1966 you didn't anticipate that there could be any changes unless it was short of revolution or something like that. Now, if you look back 8 years, mm-hmm. and we looked at this legislature as compared to the other states, mm-hmm. the South and outside of it, and the enormous changes that have occurred, would you believe that, looking back now, all the changes that have occurred could have occurred in that period of time?
Well, it would have been a little hard to realize prior to, prior to 1967.
What prompted that whole momentum?
I don't know if you can pick out a single factor. I think probably a combination of circumstances. Of course, many states have reapportioned, and not just Florida. I think reapportionment was one of the keys, and without it, very little change would have occurred, because the legislature had to reflect much more adequately the concerns of the people of Florida. And until we reapportioned in 66 and 67, it just didn't do that. So that once it was reapportioned, there was a great desire on the part of the new majority in the House and the Senate to catch up and to change things. Now, to go beyond that, there are a couple of other factors that may be unique with Florida. One, we probably had more changing to do than most states. I doubt very seriously that there are very many states that were more malapportioned than Florida. I have not researched a point or looked back, but it seemed to me that the majority of the House and the majority of the Senate in Florida could be elected by roughly between 12% and 13% of the population, basically those who lived in the smaller north and northwestern counties of Florida. And so that we were quite malapportioned until we did get reapportionment. And also, I guess starting with 1944, 1945, the end of World War II, Florida just continued to accelerate and growth and change in the whole population distribution throughout the state. And as a consequence, although many states reapportioned, the new legislature reflected a population of a state that had undergone tremendous change itself within a 20-year period of time. And it involved not just a growth in population, but really a slightly different kind of population, a complete change of geographic emphasis within the state. Y'all, I'm sure, are quite familiar with Florida's population development, but our capital was selected simply because it was about halfway between the two population centers of the state. That is St. Augustine on the east coast and Pensacola on the west. And our whole population axis ran from the St. Augustine, Jacksonville area through the north and west part of the state to Pensacola until, I guess, really the turn of the century. And in the 1920s, population began to develop in the lower east coast, the Gold Coast area, and central and Florida and the west coast area. So that today, the bulk of Florida's population really lives in central and south Florida, and they are people who have in-migrated from other states who come in with a variety of backgrounds. Once we were reapportioned, the balance of power shifted geographically, and it shifted to a different population mix. For instance, in terms of racial composition, the attitudes from Jacksonville through this area and Pensacola are quite similar to those in South Georgia and Alabama. And I would say, though, that in the rest of the state, you've had many people who did not grow up, whose parents and grandparents had lived in the area. In areas that were never in a black belt with any type of an antebellum economy, not that they are automatically liberals on racial issues, but they didn't have the same type of conditioning. My own grandparents came into this state in the 20s, one set from Wyoming and one set from Tennessee. And in time for me to be a Floridian, but many of the people who lived in Central and South Florida came from many, many other places. And the black population, well, you tended to have in-migration of whites, you tended to have out-migration of blacks, so that even on racial matters, the population in my district has gone from slightly over 20% black down now to about 14% black, and I expect by the time the next census it will be less than 10% black. In terms of absolute numbers, the black population probably will have some slight increase, but the big increase has been the in-migration of whites.
Carol?
Yes.
It's apparent to us that the Florida legislature had so far to go in terms of malapportionment. But what about in terms of its operation, its staffing, the quality of its members, the product that you produce? As you look at other states in the South, do you see a difference between what you're doing?
Well, I don't know how to compare the quality of our members with members of other legislatures. Perhaps you could, you know, do
right,
that
within
better
the state.
Than I.
Within
within the state. I can give you an illustration. Before reapportionment, the chronological age level of the House was much greater than it is now. And I think in the more settled rural environment, with greater emphasis on stability and seniority and everything like that, there are just many old-timers around. And in the urban areas that were badly underrepresented, the seats in the legislature were so worthless that they're really that the so-called vested interest didn't worry too much about them, as they didn't really count up here anyway, and with rare exception, so that the young idealistic lawyer or somebody else could generally run for the seats, and no one was too concerned with him getting elected or trying to crowd him out. I think we had some extremely able people serving from the urban areas before reapportionment. The problem was they were just submerged. I could give a number of illustrations. My own delegation from Hillsborough County had for years three House members, and I would say generally one or two of the three were among the most able men in the legislature with all of the credentials anybody else, but they would come up here, they would not be in the majority block, so they would not be selected for any leadership post, committee chairman, they would not be assisted in developing important legislation. saw that a contemporary of theirs who came from the right area, namely Doyle Connor, for instance, who is now the Commissioner of Agriculture, who came up here from Stark, was no more able, in fact, perhaps not as able as some folks from urban areas, but he just simply got thrust into leadership pretty well by his caucus, so that he went onward and upward very rapidly, and the others began to get just completely frustrated about the whole thing and drop out or run for something else. We had a fair turnover in the urban areas with fairly good people. They were just not too visible or too many of them. And it could very well be that Florida is a slightly more urban state than some of our sister southern states, so I understand things are changing in many of those. And I think generally, though not necessarily, a representative from an urban area is apt to be a little bit, I can again think of some very notable exceptions, but he's generally apt to be a little bit more aggressive, have a little bit more in terms of educational attainment and some things of that nature. And it could very well be that the vested interest did not have the situation organized so that with reapportionment and a great deal of representation was added to the urban areas, you had a host of eager young men and a few women who were ready to rush in and tilt with windmills and who came from relatively sophisticated constituencies. No, that's probably not right, but I think the urban makeup of the state and its population mix contributed somewhat to this. I don't know if I had to look beyond it for any other factor, I would say that there are a fair number of people up here who all went to the University of Florida and who were fairly active in a student government organization that, again, was perhaps not typical. I would say at the University of Florida, comparing it to other state universities in the region, has had several traditions that are relatively unique. University of Florida has never compared very favorably with the University of Alabama or Mississippi in football. We've been trying, but we've never quite done it. But in terms of intercollegiate debate, the University of Florida has been virtually the, at least in the southeastern region, the Notre Dame of the debate world. And when I was an undergraduate, we would have as many as 50 debaters on the road any one weekend competing in debate tournaments ranging from Chicago to Dallas to Atlanta or wherever you might have. And I can look through the so that any young man or woman who went to the University of Florida who was interested in government and politics felt that a valuable part of that of training to be prepared for that was to participate in student government at the University of Florida, where students perhaps were given more responsibility than they were at many other universities, and was a big thing, and an intercollegiate debate. And I can look around state government and find many of my colleagues who served with me in student government at the University of Florida who are active in intercollegiate debate and who are in Florida Blue Key who have continued that activity in the legislature. And that could be one thing lurking in the background, but I don't know how that compares to other states.
Who are some of those people?
Well, let's see. Our present governor was fairly active in it, though he was not at the University of Florida. He did his undergraduate work here at Florida State in Tallahassee, and he is probably the first student who's a product of the Florida State system, when they became co-ed, was quite similar to the one at the University of Florida, though he did his law school work at Florida. Bob Chevin, who is on the cabinet, who's our attorney general, I'd almost have to get out a list real quickly, but I can pick out probably a dozen or two Blue Key members who are fairly active in both chambers, who are committee chairmen such as that. I can.
Is there a general emphasis at the university on public service and on?
Florida Blue Key really was the founding chapter of what became nationally the Blue Key organization, and later it felt that the quality of the organization was being diluted, so it withdrew from the national organization it helped found, and has just continued to be unaffiliated with any national organization. And looking at the Senate, Senator Horn, the President of the Senate, was Chancellor of the Honor Court in our student government system and a member of Florida Blue Key. Senator Delapart, the Senate Pro Tem, was a President of the student body at the University of Florida, although he was not selected for Blue Key, primarily because he did his undergraduate work at Emory. Came back and was very active in student affairs as a law student, and was a summer school President of the student body, and if he'd had a little undergraduate involvement, he probably would have been selected. Dick Pettigrew was a President of Florida Blue Key and was active in debate, though he was not one of the varsity debaters. Bob Shevin, who served with him, Ken Myers. Ken was not in intercollegiate debate, but he and I were partners in the law school moot court competition. I can look through the House here. Jack Shreve, who is chairman of our Committee on Criminal Justice, was a Blue Key President. Bill Birchfield, who serves in the chairman of one of our committees, is a very active in student government. I think that perhaps
now, were these people you named and yourself at University of Florida all at the same time, or many of them?
Pretty well, but it spreads out. United States Senator Holland was in his student days was active. Senator Smathers was active in debate and was the President of the student body. I would say that I had the list of all these people. I could move through and pick them out fairly quickly. But
are they basically in the late 50s and early 60s that they were at the university?
Well, Holland and Smathers were there prior to World War II.
No, I was talking about the group you mentioned.
But, the group I'm there, pretty much I came in in 48, 49, 50, through the mid-50s. And I think that the activist of the day, instead of going out with petitions and everything like that, generally tended to get active in student government and also to participate in intercollegiate debate and such as that, and to look forward to and to prepare himself for some type of a service role in state government.
Has that continued from, has that tradition been followed at the university?
Reasonably well. I don't know. I've not, it's not, I don't think, an overly conscious, deliberate thing. That is, it will dissipate a little because we've had the considerable expansion of the state university system since then.
But when you got here and have, you know, the first 4 or 5 or 6 years here, you began to run into a lot of people you already knew.
Oh, yes.
Just like-minded people
from that group,
together.
From that group that mm-hmm. started after the war and went through about 55.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, these were not strangers.
Oh, no, I knew many of the guys before I ran and when I came up here. For instance, the congressman that when he was our state senator, I came up here to work for. Had been a member of Florida Blue Key and active in student government at the University of Florida.
Was there a conscious feeling, particularly on those who came 2 or 4 years after you, and during that period in the middle 60s, of coming up here to turn things around?
Oh, yeah, I think most of these people, with the exception maybe of one or two who came from rural areas who felt reasonably comfortable with the status quo, tended to settle by and large in urban areas and to reflect that point of view and were quite anxious to change and to catch up.
Somebody told us that in Florida that being a state legislator has status. More so than probably any other southern state.
Well, I don't know. I would say that it's, I would think so, yes. I would say that it's reflects credit to be a member of the state legislature here rather than not. I think the public in Florida, like the public generally, may have a tendency to depreciate elected public officials somewhat. But I think that individually, most members of the legislature are reasonably well regarded by their constituencies. We lose more people out of the House because of attrition, and that is because they quit or they run for some other office, and because they get defeated at the polls, though there are occasions when that occurs. I would say that most of our members of the legislature are reasonably well regarded.
The combination of the Sunshine Law and the Public Disclosure Law, aside from the obvious public benefits of both, what effect does that have on the members insofar as putting pressure on them, I guess I'm trying to say? Is that a deterrent against serving?
All right, the Sunshine Law?
Combined with the Disclosure Law.
Well, I don't think that the Sunshine Law is any deterrent to serving. To some extent, it complicates the way we work, but I think it does it in a beneficial sort of a way. I could illustrate. When I first became a member of the Appropriations Committee, near the end of the term, we passed the General Appropriations Act. I was elected. I was selected to be one of the House conferees on the conference committee. It was the first time I had served on a conference committee, and it was a big deal, and I was looking forward to it. And one of my House conferees was Bob Graham, who was chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Well, Bob had been real active in student government in Florida. He had been a chancellor of the Honor Court and was in Florida Blue Key and a good student. And so I was discussing with Bob what we needed to do to be effective on this conference committee, because we were the two junior members of it, and we had a strong position we wanted to maintain in the allocation of funds for higher education. And we felt we're going to have an uphill battle because of the graybeards on the Senate side, Jack Matthews, who was the president of the Senate, and Mallory Horn and Reuben Askew and some others who were fairly tough conferees. Well, Bob had checked out of some library a treatise written by a doctoral student at Harvard analyzing the success of conferees on conference committees in the Congress. And we both read that to be properly prepped for this experience, and it seemed to indicate that the most effective conferee frequently was just the one who was the most obstinate. So we tried to fortify our position not only with logic and reason and everything like that, but a great deal of obstinacy also. And I've departed a little bit from your question, and bring me back into it, if you will. You were asking about the Sunshine Law. That conference committee did its work in a weekend. We went out to Mallory Horn's Lake Place, and the House and Senate conferees got together. The staff director was there. We went through the issues. The people were very candid, except for the primary issue Bob and I were interested in. The whole thing was done over the weekend, and we had to wait a week to rationalize a way of compromising our issue, but it was done out of the sunshine. Now, when the conference committee meets, there are going to be 150 people in the audience, and the newspapers are going to be there, and it's going to generally take more time. Not necessarily, but generally. But the good effect of that is that the public has a much better awareness of why changes are made, what they are, and I think that there is a greater feeling of acceptance on what's done, and I think perhaps we avoid some mistakes that we might make by letting people know what's coming before it arrives, to get a reaction from them before we finally wrap it all up and it's done. The effect of financial disclosure, I don't know what that really will be. Many people are doing it voluntarily now, and I suspect that this session will pass some legislation. I have an idea that will probably keep some people from running. Some of them will be people you may not want to run, and others will be people who just, that is a straw that breaks the camel's back, and it just finally makes it that much more complicated. And it tends to be more complicated for a part-time public official than one who is perhaps on the payroll full-time. One other thing I think that may have made a difference in Florida that's not occurred too often, and that is We had a Republican governor who was elected in 1966, and I think that he may have contributed unintentionally a great deal to